cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We have Dan Moorhead here from Pantera Capital as well, founder and CEO. What a day, what a week to talk to Dan Moorhead and to talk about what's going on in crypto.
It's not only Dan Moorhead. We've got Dan, of course, who is founder and CEO of Pantera Capital. And then we also have Jay Clayton. He's the former SEC chair, non-executive chairman of Apollo Global Management. And we're making you guys stand. I don't know why. I don't know why we're making you stand, but we are.
I'll stand too. You know what? A little bit of solidarity here.
Now it's radio, but I still look short when you stand.
Thank you for being with Matt and myself. I just said to Matt, I wish I'd had an hour with you guys. First of all, let's just do some of the stuff that we went on in the panel, and we talked about crypto specifically. Big week when it comes to cryptocurrencies. I know, Jay, I kind of put you on the spot about saying, do we think Chair Gensler is doing the right thing? How do you see cryptocurrencies longer term?
Well, I think we talked about that.
Yeah.
People refer to crypto and they think of a product. Crypto is really a technology. It's blockchain technology, distributed ledger technology that manifests itself in many products. I believe that 10 years from now, there will continue to be blockchain-based products. I expect that blockchain or some transformative technology like it will come to the traditional financial system, and we're going to see that. I think we should be looking to accommodate that. And then at the same time, there are products that clearly have been offered, sold, and traded inconsistent with our rules. And we've got to deal with that.
Dan, I want you to weigh in on what happened this week, and I'll stand too, just in solidarity.
Yeah, so I think Jay's point spot on is that, you know, it's a very important technology. 300 or 400 million people are already using it. We just have to establish rules that allow entrepreneurs in the space to build things. So that we can keep growing the technology, especially domestically, rather than pushing it offshore.
I mean, there was so much fraud. There was so much pump and dump. There was so much, you know, so many rug pulls. Clearly, a lot of the coins that we saw ICO over the past few years should have been dealt with by the SEC. So I think, you know, even people in the industry are probably happy about that. What is left, Dan? You know, aside from blockchain, what else is there that's not a security in terms of tokens?
Well, anytime you have a very disruptive new technology, people try a lot of things. In hindsight, some didn't work, right? And if you think back to the dot-com boom, there were a lot of ideas that were tried. And I guess we didn't want to buy cans of pet food on the internet, right? But like a lot of other ideas,
not until
did work.
Well, we are now.
You know, yeah. Now everybody buys literally everything for his pet on the internet.
Exactly, and that's one of my favorite things. Nobody remembers who the dope was that was majority owner of Pets.com. It was this guy who thought the technology would be really impactful. Tried pet food, that didn't work. He also tried books, and so Jeff Bezos is doing fine, even though he was the majority owner of Pets.com. And that's basically what's happening in the token space. We're trying a lot of ideas. Some, like Ethereum, you know, work really well, and some just didn't work well.
Well, when it comes to the regulatory framework, Jay, can we compare what's going on in blockchain and crypto to the dot-com era? Is it apples to apples or not necessarily? It's different.
I think it rhymes. I think it rhymes.
Oh, you do?
I do. We talked a little bit about this before.
Yeah.
Look at the stable coin. I say the stable coins that were truly stable, truly backed. Look at the uptake in that and the efficiencies that that created. Now, if we can have that kind of retail dollar, you know, basically digital dollar,
right.
People talk, that's what a stable coin, a truly well-functioning, well-structured, well-regulated stable coin is, a digital dollar. The power of that versus the power of carrying cash, think about it.
It's fantastic, but it still is like pulling teeth, getting Tether to properly report, you know, everything that it holds. Disclosure is key, isn't it, Dan? Why don't people just come up with it?
It is, and obviously I can't speak of why Tether doesn't do that, but USDC, that's done by Circle and Coinbase, incredibly transparent, incredibly stable. It's backed by, you know, very short-term, high-quality treasury debt. That is something you can really see what it is, and, you know, frankly, it's a lot more transparent than a bank is. I have no idea what my bank's actually doing with my money.
We learned that this year, right? I mean, a lot of people didn't realize.
We're going to let Jay come in on that.
To Matt's point, look, regulation has to have all the key elements. It has to have investor protection. We learned that, right? It has to have prudential regulation, you know, for the system. It has to have that. And it also has to have AML, KYC, you know, the law enforcement, illicit activity, deterrence. You've got to get those things right, but you can get those things right and still have innovation.
By the way, that's another thing that's come out this year. Not that it surprised anybody, but a number of crypto firms were like instructing clients how to use VPNs in order to essentially cheat the system, right? Does that happen on in traditional finance on Wall Street as well, or have they learned their lesson not to mess with the SEC in that way?
I think most retail products, activity like that is non-existent or aggressively and effectively deterred.
You were laughing.
No, I appreciate it. You know, anybody that's committing a crime or a fraud should be hammered, right? Like that, I agree with that.
But I will say, you know, our markets, one of the areas where we have the most difficulty as regulators is activity that takes place offshore that affects our markets. That is one of the more difficult places. And I'll tell you that when I was at the SEC, you know, trades came in large batches from offshore. Large batch trades make it difficult to detect illicit activity. One of the things that we did was unbatch those trades,
right,
so that people couldn't combine what was fraudulent or illicit activity with otherwise, you know, legitimate trading.
I did kind of wonder over the last few years, every time I interviewed Sam Bankman-Fried, I was like, why is this effective altruist in the Bahamas? Is it just that he likes the sun? Is he just a beach guy?
Probably
at heart?
Not.
You know, he didn't seem like a beach guy.
What I'm curious is, when you look back at your time at the SEC, is there something that you wish you had done more of when it comes to crypto and blockchain?
Well, look, anytime you look back, I mean, you know, you look back at this interview, you're going to say, gosh, I wish I asked him that. So when you look back, you always, you know, that's human behavior.
But you do look back. Like, is there something you thought you wish you had done?
Oh, sure. Look, I do think that a safe place for this innovation is stablecoin. And I wish that we had worked together across the federal financial regulators to give a clear indication of what is a very safe, well-regulated stablecoin that touches all those places: investor protection, stability, AML, KYC, deterrence of illicit activity. I think that it's doable, and I wish we'd done it.
Yeah. So it's great that we're getting some regulatory clarity here, even if it's not the kind of clarity that everybody would have wanted. Are we, though, killing the industry in this country, Dan? I mean, is it a problem that, you know, we're going to talk about battery technology a little bit later on, and how U.S. regulation basically destroyed our chances of leading in that technology, and now China owns it, right? Car batteries, electric car batteries. Are we doing the same thing right now to crypto?
Well, there has been a, you know, very pronounced movement to have crypto companies based outside the United States. And so I think it is different than the way the U.S. treated the internet itself, where all the large internet companies are based in the U.S.
So that's a bad thing. I mean, because that is like what San Francisco is all about now.
Well, and I'm going to go back to – go ahead.
No, and look, we have a couple of recent data points, and they're just recent data points, but foreign governments are using the blockchain to issue sovereign debt as a test case. Yeah. And if they're doing that, they're thinking – you know, have ha, do we have an efficiency assisting technology, an enhancing technology here? And you're seeing governments support that question, support the answer to that question. I think we ought to be doing that too.
You know, we're seeing it now today with AI as well.
Well, we kicked off the conversation today. I was saying, you know, let's look at climate and what's going on. And you said, like, we need to have global cooperation in order for anything to be productive and get done, correct?
Yes.
And it's the same thing with crypto and blockchain.
Or why are you worried about the climate, Carol?
Because I'm going to be living in the metaverse wearing
the Apple
headset.
No, because we can't
breathe
when we go outside in New York City where 10% of all, you know, United States financial activity happens. Like, it's a big problem for the economy. And for my daughter.
Real quickly, because we only have about a minute left, 30 seconds on how you see the market, the broader market environment right now. Because there's mixed data.
Yeah, so I still think that, you know, rates have to be high for longer than most people think. There's no working age person that's traded in a rising rate environment. And so we all keep thinking, oh, it's just buy the dip, buy the dip. And there was a 42-year, there's a 42-year bull market in rates. There might be a, you know, 4 or 5 year bear market in rates, and it might impact interest rate sensitive sectors like stocks, real estate. And that's why I do think blockchain's nice, because it's not interest rate sensitive.
Saved you 25 seconds. Outlook, broad macro.
We continue to be surprised to the upside, and we should ask ourselves why.
Love it. Guys, thank you so much, and thanks for sticking around. Thanks for doing the panel with us. We really appreciate it. Jay Clayton, former chairman of the SEC, non-executive chairman of Apollo Global Management, Dan Moorhead, founder and CEO of Pantera Capital, joining us here at Bloomberg Invest. Pretty cool, right?
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
I've been thinking a lot about the energy world and climate. Just look outside our window. We've got a great guest to talk about it. Charles Bailey is co-president of Quantum Energy Partners here with us in the link at Bloomberg headquarters. Thanks, first of all, for participating in Bloomberg Invest. I know you were up on stage with Alex. How do you think about the energy transition? How should we be thinking about it?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. It's exciting to be here. You've got a lovely building and just so much going on here today over these 2 days. So absolutely fantastic. Energy transition, I think we need to spend a lot more time thinking about it. It is the biggest event that is happening in the world right now. We are going to be spending trillions upon trillions, probably hundreds of trillions of dollars to make this thing work. And we need to make sure that that money is spent wisely so that we can all be living a reasonable, healthy, we can
not in the
walk
metaverse,
outside and breathe.
Not in the
exactly.
metaverse.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, for those listeners who aren't in the New York area, we've been blanketed by an orange fog over the last couple of days because of the wildfires out of Canada. Wildfire season typically doesn't start this early, so this is, a lot of people are saying, as a result of climate change. Are we going to be able to beat it? Are you optimistic? Before we get into the money part, which is actually, I think, very interesting, but in terms of actually beating climate change, what do you think?
I think, Matt, I think that is a fascinating question. I think if you look at it for purely from a U.S. point of view, I think we have a very good chance of getting to sort of net zero by 2050. But unfortunately, it's not a U.S. issue. It is a global issue, as we've seen Canadian wildfire smoke coming down to the U.S.
It's 27 years from now.
It's 27 years from now, but we've been talking about this for 15 years. We've spent $15 trillion trying to build solar, wind, and batteries, and we've done a great job building it. But what percent of total energy production around the world does solar, wind, and batteries represent? 3%. Guess how much it guess, you know, people are 10% of the people in the world are still burning, you know, wood and cow dung and things. So transitions take incredibly long periods of time to happen. And I think we've just got to be, we've got to be mindful that, you know, oil and gas will probably be here for a while. And therefore, we need to think about ways that we can remove carbon from oil and gas if we're going to continue to use that, as well as build out solar, wind, and batteries.
Can we do that? Can we remove carbon?
Well, you know,
how can we do it more effectively?
I think we can. I think we can. There are technologies existing today that allow us to do it. You can do it. I don't want to get too technical, but for example, it's what is a gas molecule? A gas molecule is a carbon with four hydrogen. You can strip the carbon off, put it back in the ground, and you've got four hydrogen molecules. Hydrogen is a pretty potent energy source. So that's one way to do it. That'd be pre-combustion. We're very good at that. Post-combustion, burning gas, for example, and capturing the carbon afterwards is a more expensive proposition. We can do it, but it's not economic right
now.
That,
to me, makes no sense. Like, we've got to do it earlier on, right, from the get-go.
I think we do. I think we do, and there are a number of, like, it's interesting. If you look at European super majors, for the most part, so like the Shells of the world, they've largely said, we are going to invest in solar and wind. We're going to put a lot of money into that. The U.S. super majors, take Chevron, take Exxon, I think they, and this is a gross generalization, but they've largely said, our expertise is oil and gas. We're going to continue to invest in oil and gas. And the problem's not oil and gas. It's the carbon that is created from that. So let's find ways to remove carbon. We'll also invest in hydrogen. We'll invest in sequestration of carbon, things like that. But we're going to focus on our strengths.
Which approach do you like better?
I think both are great, but the second to me is more realistic. And the reason the markets, you know, as you guys know better than I do, I don't follow the public markets, but U.S. supermajors trade at twice the multiple that European supermajors do. So I guess the market's saying something there as to what is economically more viable. And I think if we look at where we actually have reduced the most carbon over the last 10 or 20 years, the U.S. has done it. We've reduced our carbon emissions by about a billion tons of carbon, and we've done that largely by transitioning, removing coal and transitioning to gas.
Now, Bloomberg Business Week is pretty focused on the energy transition right now. Yesterday, Carol and I were talking about
the permitting
process, even to get a power line.
17 years.
If you decide to build a wind park, right, you're not going to do it in Manhattan, so you do it farther away. You have to build a line from there to where we use the power, and it takes 17 years sometimes to get permits or longer.
This story actually talked about Republicans and Democrats coming together, the renewable industry and the fossil fuel industry coming together because the process is so bad.
But still, how do you invest in that kind of
Me started on this. I mean, if we want the transition to work properly, we're going to basically our transition is all about electrifying things, using electrons versus using carbon molecules. If we want to electrify everything, it means we need to build out our grid. We largely have not invested in our grid since 1975, right? And if you thought it was hard to build a gas pipeline, it is even harder to build a high voltage transmission line. The reason is, in my mind, a gas pipeline is largely FERC, which is a federal agency, oversees that. And so they can say, states, listen, we're doing this. For a high transmission line, if you want to bring energy from Quebec down to, you know, one of the southern states, it has to go by all these states that are going to get no benefit. They're going to shut it down. Like, why would they vote for it? So we need to improve the permitting process. But then the second thing I just want to point out, there is more energy out there in solar, wind, and battery projects today than currently exists on the whole grid that is waiting to be connected to the grid, but can't be because the operators of the grid just can't figure out how to connect.
That makes
so
me sick.
So the interconnection is like 3.5 years. You build something, you got it ready to go, 3.5 years.
If you had to pick one thing that's holding it up, is it states, local government? Like, what is it?
I think there are a bunch of different things, but I think if we want to accelerate the transition, we need to build more transmission lines, which is changing regulation. We need to make sure that we, like, we call this an energy transition and we call it a clean energy transition. Mm. I think it is largely. But if we want to move to solar, wind, and batteries, we're going to be using huge amounts of materials, metals. We have to open 300 new mines. So whether we like it or not, we're going to have to permit some more mines and get the permitting going there. And then we've got to really start building.
Charles, what's the biggest bang for your buck? If you're an investor, and ESG has become kind of a dirty word, but let's not use that phrase. But if you're an investor who wants to make a change as well as a profit, what do you do?
Well, I said this before. We can do almost anything we want to do in the U.S., but in the U.S., we produce, 20 years ago, we produced 6 billion tons of carbon. Now we're at 5. We've gone down by a billion. So we should be pretty happy. In China?
Still 5 billion.
But it's still 5 billion. But in China, they were 6 20 years ago. Now they're 12.
Yeah.
And they're going up. And India's going up. So I would say we need to develop tech. So it goes back to VC, venture capital. We need to develop technologies, and I think Bill Gates has really talked about this, that will allow us to decarbonize sectors like the 50% of the carbon emissions that are related to agriculture or the four pillars of civilization, cement, steel, fertilizer. And if we didn't have fertilizer, we'd probably have half the people we have today, and plastics.
Why isn't money going there?
They're just very difficult problems. And the return profile is not as obvious a return profile, I would say. There are some interesting opportunities and interesting venture investments that are being made in those spaces, but these are industries that have existed for hundreds of years, right?
Right.
In the case of cement. And you can't, you know, if you're building a building out of cement, you don't want it to fall down. It takes a while to approve the new type of cement that's being made and the strength of it and all that. So it's a lengthy process.
So is this what you focus on at Quantum Energy Partners? You're looking into venture capital and the energy transition?
Well, we focus on venture capital and the energy transition. And that's, to get back, Matt, to your question, I think we need to develop technologies that can be spread around the world, because if most of the carbon's being emitted, not in the U.S. but elsewhere, we have to transmit those ideas to elsewhere.
I have to say, that's one of the themes that keeps coming out. We talked about it with Jay Clayton and Dan Moore. Whether it's crypto, whether it's climate, you know, we saw it with the pandemic. You really needed to globally cooperate.
Yep.
Is that likely to happen?
You tell me.
I don't know. You tell me.
No, like, what do we, no, it's not.
Because in a world that feels like it's getting divided.
I think it's tough. The reason is that I think there are three reasons that people focus on energy. I mean, energy has created civilization. I think we can all agree with that. The three reasons that people sort of vilify energy are, number one, it's created these climate issues. The second is it's incredibly important because it creates energy security and allows your country to continue on. And the third big concept is this whole equity, like getting people energy and everyone around the world energy at a reasonable price. I think in the U.S. we have focused almost exclusively, at least before the Ukraine, on the climate. But every other country that is not developed, if you had a choice, if you're out there and you're boiling water over a wood fire, do you care about the climate, or do you care about getting the next meal on your plate? Do you care about energy security if you're India and really concerned about running your country? I mean, you've got to balance these issues.
Will you come back?
I would love to. Thank you. I'm sorry for talking so much.
No.
Thank you for having me.
No, we love to hear it, so thanks very much.
All right, we got to run. Charles Bailey, he's co-president at Quantum Energy Partners.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I am wondering what the attitude is when it comes to the venture capital market.
Good question, especially after the collapse of SVB.
Yeah, exactly, right? Silicon Valley Bank, a big influence. We did see VC capital in climate tech reach a record $70.1 billion last year, so it was up a lot from 2021. I know. Do you like what I did there?
I like it.
All right. So, and in total, I think the world's spending something like $1.1 trillion on climate technology. It's certainly front and center for us, but let's see what our guest has to say about the broader VC landscape. Delighted to have with us, and she's been here at Bloomberg Invest, Rebecca Caden, managing partner at Union Square Ventures, right here on site at Bloomberg headquarters. Rebecca, hello. How are you?
Were you on a panel with Charles Bailey earlier?
No, I was on a panel with Dina.
Oh, okay. Because he calls it venture energy.
That's another way to do it.
Carol calls it climate tech, which I like better. I think you have a better phrase.
Well, thank you very much.
Except for the fact that
I think there's a problem.
It is kind of the VC stage of what, of energy, of the energy transition, of...
I think climate tech is a more expansive word than energy. Energy is a piece of it, but when you think about climate tech, you also think about decarbonization technologies, a broader set to, you know, focus on the climate crisis.
All right, we like climate tech better.
We do, we do, we do. Check, check, check. All right, so start broader.
Sure.
How's VC, what's the VC space and what's going on, especially in a year where, you know, I think about 12 months or 6 months between crypto uncertainties, the regional bank uncertainties. Talk to us about how all of this, these stress points, have impacted the VC world.
Yeah, look, the VC world has been through it in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
If you think about what it looked like then versus now, there's been macro uncertainty. There's been market seizing up from a growth capital perspective.
Higher rates.
Higher rates, which are driving that, right? A lot of the capital that was there, you know, a year or so ago has pulled out of the market, creating a very, very different funding environment. At the same time, you have the emergence of AI, or rather the boom of AI, which is creating frenzy and excitement and a potential technology shift. You have
are people pulling the levers, actually, rather than just euphoria?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keep going.
You're seeing a lot of funding go into it. You're seeing excitement, and you're seeing optimism that we have a technology shift that's going to unlock new great businesses and platforms and opportunities. You're also seeing sectors like climate still attract a lot of capital and feel like there's massive white space to build in important ways. And you're seeing some of what's going on in big tech create new talent markets, right? Founders are starting companies. They're tired of being at some of these big platforms, or they're being laid off from big platforms, mm-hmm. and that's creating new talent opportunities. So in some ways, it's a complicated story after a long time of an uncomplicated story, where there's some things that are quite exciting and then a lot of uncertainty.
For me, that last part is really exciting, because we talk about mm-hmm. the layoffs in Silicon Valley all the time, but I always assume that, you know, programmer fired, goes to another company, continues to be a programmer. You're saying that people are coming out and saying, you know what, I want to work for myself. I'm going to start my own company. I have
Absolutely.
This idea. And that's awesome.
Yeah, look, if you've been in a large platform being paid super well and then you're laid off, but you've had an idea and you see some of the shifts going on, you say, now's my time. I don't want to go back to a big company. I'm going to go for it. And, you know, while the growth markets are quite tight right now, the seed markets are really there. There's still, you know, a lot of capital that's interested in particularly the buzziest categories. And so you're seeing talent influx.
I love the startup world and the VC world. So tell me some of the kind of companies that are being started at this point.
Well, you're obviously seeing a lot of influx of innovation and talent into AI
across. What specifically? Because we're talking about AI, and then it's like, okay, is it that chatbot that Matt hates, or is it something more constructive?
I think it's probably both, right? I think you're seeing some fun entertainment kind of tools come from it, but also a lot of thinking about how is AI going to create efficiency and value and cost savings in industries like learning, education, healthcare, places where...
I just saw Khan Academy, and they have right. been really embracing it and just came out with a chat bot basically to help with kids with learning.
Yeah, if you think about learning, for instance, right, learning has been a constrained industry, right, mm-hmm. where it's what you're able to access is almost directly correlated to who you are and what you come from. And the ability for one-to-one individualized learning to be driven through technology can unlock massive opportunities, both in businesses to be created and in learning to be done, not only in K-12 and young, but lifelong learning. If you think about job training,
right.
we have major parts of our economy right now who are really supply constrained. Healthcare, for instance, if you can think about what AI can do for job training and unlocking some of that, massive opportunities there.
True.
Are you thinking about your next career and what training you might need?
No, I've been in a 2 week long discussion with ChatGPT about Yahtzee and probabilities and statistics. I've learned an incredible amount.
Rebecca, don't indulge him.
I never knew how deep this game
was. Please, don't indulge him.
No, I just think it's really, really fascinating. I also think it's interesting that the seed market is still healthy.
Yeah.
So there is still money there, and investors are willing to give it to founders if they like the idea, if they like the team. What do they want to see?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when you think about the later stage markets, they've gotten a lot tougher, largely mm-hmm. because the goalposts have moved, right? It used to be growth at all costs. How fast can you grow? And now there's a lot of focus, and probably in the long term, rightly so, on how solid is this business? What are the unit economics? What is the sightline to profitability? Just different kind of goals. And it's going to take some time for industries to adapt to that. But in early stages, when you're talking about seeds, it's much different. It's about what is this business you're going to build. And a lot of the capital that is hesitating at growth stage is just going earlier. Mm-hmm. They're saying, maybe we're not comfortable writing those bigger checks. We'll write smaller checks for now. And so it's inundating the seed market. And while some of those large players have pulled out of the growth market, they really haven't of the seed market. So you're still finding a lot of capital and opportunity in seeds. And after a long time where it wasn't really there, you're seeing potentials for technology shifts where investors are more excited than ever to deploy capital, right? Like thinking about climate or AI, they're dreaming about what these spaces can look like in a way that has been harder to do.
So is that a positive indicator that more money is going into seed, or is it because it's a smaller investment one-up, if you will? It's a sign of VC investors being more cautious.
Yes, it is definitely a sign of some growth stage investors being more cautious, and it can create risks, right? Because if you seed fund a lot of businesses and then there isn't money later for them,
right,
you're going to create a crunch.
Right.
And so we have to make sure that that doesn't happen, and that especially for the highest quality businesses, there's capital to carry them through so that we get the innovation cycles to play out. I'm optimistic that there will be, but generally allowing a lot of new businesses to be created when new technology there is a very good thing.
What was the impact directly on the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank? What did you see?
I mean, I think...
Did you have companies that were impacted?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in the end, the impact was not that much because there was a bailout and no one lost the money. But I think there was a reality check that macroeconomic climate is very real and it affects early stage innovation no matter how early you are, and that you don't innovate removed from that. And sometimes I think it can feel that way. And so I think there's a much greater awareness to what's going on from a macroeconomic perspective and managing balance sheets than there was before. And just an awareness that you have to pay attention to the world you're building in.
Well, I always ask VCs what they're excited about in terms of companies that they're kind of bringing along here. A lot of times they feel they don't want to answer. I don't know why. People are not specific about it. But you're a managing partner at Union Square Ventures. Is there a company that you're excited about? Is there a team that you're like, yes, we, or a product where you're
totally
like, what? Tell us something.
Do you have a favorite child?
I definitely don't have a favorite child, but there's lots of things I'm super excited about. We've been talking about AI, so I'll talk about Alife. Alife is a healthcare AI business that's driving AI into the fertility process. So looking at areas where it's been reliant on human decision making and instead taking large data sets and allowing doctors to augment their decisions with AI driven tools. That's massive to creating efficiency in that industry, and there's a lot of money in that. So that's one I'm particularly excited about.
You know, it's cool, right?
Yeah.
Like you think about what AI can do in terms of, I always think about going through research data. There's no way forgive me, that the medical community can keep up on everything. So you think about what this can mean.
Yeah, anywhere where humans make decisions based on personal experience but would benefit from instead universal data sets to drive what they're deciding to do, AI is going to be a massively powerful tool set.
Wow. You're really smart.
Thanks for having me.
I want to have you back on. By the way, I wanted to ask you, unrelated.
Quick.
Has the Great American Novel been written?
Definitely not.
Okay. Because she studied literature at Harvard.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. Okay. To Kill a Mockingbird?
Infinite Jest, I would think.
I mean, come on.
But,
there's always left to be written.
There's stuff. Rebecca, this was fun. So much. So appreciate it.
Thank you.
And so glad you could stop by. Rebecca Caden, she's managing partner at Union Square Ventures.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
It is electric, increasingly a global electric society. I mean, the EV race, Matt, no doubt about it, it is on. And key to dominating it is batteries.
Yes.
It's a story
in Bloomberg Business Week.
That's making you angry.
It's one more in a series of stories in Bloomberg Business Week that have made me so mad. When I read them, I just want to march over to Joel Weber's desk and ask him, what's wrong with the U.S. government?
Because basically America, I mean, they could have taken the lead in electric vehicle battery production, but they kind of screwed it up. All right, this is the cover story of Bloomberg Business Week. This new issue is out on newsstands now. It's at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and, of course, on the Bloomberg terminal. So let's get to it with Business Week editor Jill Weber and Bloomberg News auto reporter Gabrielle Coppola. And she is on Zoom from Michigan. Jill is back in our studio. Jill, the story is a lot of things, in particular, upsetting because of that huge miss for the United States.
Yeah, Matt, for the record, you're welcome to march over to my desk whenever you want and, you know, unload however you see fit. So Gabby came to us with this pitch a while ago, and it was really curious, and we encouraged her to keep going, and she just kept kind of scratching away at it. And what she came back with was what I just genuinely didn't know, the story of the startup A123 that really had a head start in the EV battery space and was American. And what's crazy now is that company went bankrupt 10 years ago, and 10 years later, here we are. America makes no batteries that go into electric vehicles. And the question that we sort of had for her was, can the U.S. build an EV battery? And Gabby, why don't you walk us through where that line of reporting took you?
Sure. Hi, guys. So, yeah, I started out wanting to profile. Hello. I wanted to profile this guy named Mujeeb Ijaz, who is an entrepreneur who's trying to build an American battery company now here in Michigan. He's actually a veteran of A123. And as I dug into the story, I learned the story of A123, which, as Jill mentioned, this was a company that had a brief moment. You know, think back to 2011, 2012. GM and Chrysler had been bailed out. The Obama administration was trying to push them to build more fuel-efficient cars. And A123 thought they had a chance there. But, you know, the heart of the story is really this one question is, does America need to kind of tinker with or rethink the rules of our free enterprise American capitalism to compete with China? Because what happened is there wasn't an immediate success. You know, EV range was still kind of weak. Gas prices were coming down. So they were making batteries, but there weren't enough. Nobody wanted to buy EVs. Tesla wasn't a big thing yet. So they went bankrupt, and they were bought by a Chinese auto parts maker called Wansheng, which kind of dialed back their ambitions and had them focus on stop-start batteries, which is if you ever, you know, driven a car, you notice you're at a red light and your car, instead of idling and burning gas, it just shuts off. That's what they do. That's what A123 does. So, and so it's just so ironic when you look now at where the country is, and there's all this anxiety over, you know, geopolitical tension, economic warfare with China. And I'm not sitting here trying to promote, you know, there's a lot of things you could say about China that are critical. You know, they certainly have violated a lot of IP, American intellectual property, and that's in my story. But the story is really more about looking in the mirror for America and saying, how do we get here? You know,
Gabby,
go ahead.
Well, let's go there. Like, how did we get there? Like, if you had to point your finger at maybe one or two things, how is it that we kind of screwed this up?
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing is that we did not value manufacturing. And I say this as a reporter who worked in New York for a long time and moved to Detroit 4 years ago and has been covering the auto industry. For many decades, our idea of economic growth was we don't need manufacturing. We should just outsource it. It's a commodity, and you know we can just write apps or work at Walmart or in the service industry or whatever, and that's going to be fine. Obviously, that has not been fine. And you know, one of the things that is in the story that Joel will know, the former Intel CEO Andy Grove wrote this amazing opinion piece in Business Week in 2010, where he warned all of this was going to happen. He said, America is losing the means to scale its own technology. And if you don't control the means to make things, then you don't understand them, and you're losing part of the process. So what we thought was a commodity is actually really valuable, and we are learning that the hard way now. And then, you know, the opening of the story is this very symbolic moment that, you know, Ford Motor Company is building a new, brand-new battery factory right here in Michigan. You know, big win for the state, lots of jobs, investment, all that. But they have to license the technology from CATL, which is the world's biggest battery manufacturer, and it is a Chinese company that was nurtured on, you know, subsidies from the Chinese government. Now, I'm not knocking CATL for, you know, trying to have a big, business and being entrepreneurial, that's part of their success. It's not all subsidies. The chairman, Robin Zung, is obviously like a very smart guy, and he's built something great. But the crazy thing is that the technology that Ford is licensing, LFP, that's not to get too technical here, but LFP batteries, lithium iron phosphate batteries, are more stable and they're cheaper than what you typically see in EVs today, because those are lithium ion batteries made with nickel. And that technology, that the fact that you could, that chemistry works in batteries, was discovered by Americans at the University of Texas Austin. So we discovered this. We had a company that tried to commercialize it, and then we threw it away because we believe that free market is everything. And if you can't survive in the Darwinistic moment of the free market, then you don't deserve to exist. Period. Well,
I mean, it's
know,
just
20
one
years
of,
later.
It's just
where
actually,
are we?
Gabby. I feel like this is a problem that we have that goes across industries, and it's also not just manufacturing, right? You bring up University of Texas at Austin. One of the other horrible things that we do is we educate the world, right? We bring the smartest minds from Asia and Europe here to the United States,
right.
Give them the best education they could possibly get, and then because we're so xenophobic, we make them leave after they've built the most amazing skill sets. And it always just baffles my mind. But I want to just quickly ask you about CATL, or CATL. I was in Detroit a couple weeks ago. Last week? Was it last week?
It was last week. Yeah.
Talking to people at the Ford Motor Company about this. And I know that some on the right, including the governor of Virginia, have called this kind of a Trojan horse, because they have gone to Michigan, the Chinese, to help Ford set up this plant. And the Chinese are going to stay there as advisors on the project, right? Is there any concern that it is kind of a Trojan horse operation, or is this just kind of political,
theater?
In
yeah, I understand. I think that's a fabulous question, Matt. And like most things in life, there's a lot of nuance in that question. It's not black and white. So do I think CATL has anything but the best of intentions of trying to grow their business? No. I mean, these guys have a lot of capacity in China, and they need to find places to sell it outside China. And so they're psyched that they can do that with Ford. I also don't think that, just like any supplier, you don't always, I mean, you don't want to get, you try, just like, think about the irony of this. You know, it used to be GM and Ford and Volkswagen, everybody went to China, and they were forced to do joint ventures with Chinese companies to teach them how to make cars, but make them better at making cars. All the car companies hid their IP about how to make an engine as much as they could. They walled it off, even though they had a partnership, right? Because they didn't want China to get that. Well, China said, okay, great, you can have your engines because we're going to make batteries. But still, I think, so in terms of the risk, what people need to wrap their head around there is that CATL has the IP that America needs, not the other way around, okay? So that's one thing to think about. On the other hand, I'm not going to say that Glenn Youngkin or any of these Republicans are completely unjustified in being very cautious and being very careful and looking at this, because there are no Chinese companies that do not have, they're not under the influence of the Chinese government. It's a command economy. I don't think CATL is special. I think that's how it works, you know? So I think that we have to be pragmatic, because we are behind. And if you spoke to Ford, if you spoke to the folks, you know, GM, forget CATL. If you just want to buy processed lithium to make a battery, you can't get out. You can't do that without China yet. You know, I mean, that's what the Inflation Reduction Act and what the Biden administration is trying to really accelerate, is building that supply chain so we can do that. But we're not there yet. It doesn't happen overnight. We've been outsourcing for 50 years. Now all of a sudden we woke up and we realized, oh crap, we need to make things. You know, it's not going to happen overnight. But I think the biggest risk is that either politicians or investors do not have the stomach for that, because it kind of, you know, we have to rethink who we are and how we do things. I'm not at all suggesting we would ever want to lose or diminish the, you know, free markets and free enterprise and the freedom that makes all those people want to come study in the United States, right? We are great because of that freedom.
So what you're talking about, Gabby, is ultimately, you know, America's innovation machine. And that has been the thing that has gotten us where we are. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that S&P 500 now in a bull market on euphoria over AI. Like AI, yet another innovation that has come from American ingenuity. And yet, there, what you're ultimately talking about here is the lack of an industrial policy, right? America has no industrial policy. I'm curious, when you talk to some of the folks that are quoted in the story, what kind of insights did they have to say about what that could even look like here?
You know, I think that's a great question, and I think it's a hard question. And, you know, that's certainly a question for economists and people in government. And, you know, I think that they still want to – people still want to see – they want, you know, private capital. There want to be some competition here so that the best can survive, you know. But I think a little bit of runway. You know, I think if you look at, you know, what the Biden administration is trying to do now, I think being more willing to support, if you have, like, think about, we're already doing this, right? First of all, the Department of Defense does it already, okay? And the Department of Energy does it because all the time they are giving loans and seeding new startups and technologies. And that is also part of what the Biden administration has been doing. But the thing is, they give them money for, like, to get it out of the lab. But then when it comes to the hard work of, like, building something, that's when you're supposed to go to the private market. But guess what? Battery manufacturing is really, really hard. Just ask Elon Musk. There's, you know, there's going to be bumps in the road. And the question right. is, you know, if there's one, like A123, what pushed them over the edge was they had a recall. It wasn't a horrific problem, but it was a problem. But that gave, I mean, there were other things going on, but that gave everyone cold feet and they dropped them like a hot potato. You know, if you believe something is strategic, then you need to treat it like it's strategic. And I think our one of the other big risks to us is that, you know, the U.S. every 4 years or every 8 years, we have this major pendulum switch in our swing in our policy, right? We don't stay the course. We're inconsistent. Mm. We're not long-term. We're short-term. So I think it's...
Gabby,
yeah,
I want everyone to go out and get this magazine or look at it online, Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and read it. I do want to ask you quickly, and we only have a minute left, about the GM news that just crossed. I mean, you are there in Detroit. You covered the auto industry for us. What do you make of this agreement and the fact that now it looks like the Tesla supercharger technology is going to be the standard, the industry standard?
And just quickly.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I think that one of the major stumbling blocks to mass EV adoption is range and having enough chargers, and Tesla's already got it. So, yeah, I think, you know, when the CEOs, the titans of Detroit are, you know, acknowledging that by doing this, you know, and I think there's been urging by the Biden administration, too, to kind of share the wealth. You know, Tesla's got this big lead. You help the rest of the industry move faster to go electric.
Yeah. It is interesting in an environment where there's so much political pushback against China, certainly from the United States. Do they then say, hey, let's look at all of our American intellectual property. Let's make sure that it stays here. We'll see whether or not there's follow through on that. Gabby Coppola, auto reporter at Bloomberg News, on Zoom from Michigan, along with Jill Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. This is the cover of the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek on newsstands as we speak, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course, always on the Bloomberg Terminal. An incredible cover with Uncle Sam.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Once again, we've got a rally underway. We're just hovering near our best levels of the session, up about 1% on the NASDAQ. And we have seen officially the S&P once again 20% off that October low.
Oh, yeah, what's the level that we watch
trying
for?
Trying to find a bottom.
I think it's 4292.44.
So we're at 4293.35
right now. All
right.
We're in a bull market, Carol. We just need to close here.
All right. We'll see if we can hold because we haven't been able to do it. Let's see what our Drive to the Close guest has to say. Jeff Travis is portfolio manager over at Oak Associates. He joins us on Zoom in Akron, Ohio. Jeff, nice to have you here.
The great state of Ohio.
The great state of
Ohio. Go Buckeyes.
How significant, Jeff, is it that we've moved 20% off that October 2020 low on the S&P 500?
Well, obviously, moves off the bottom are always exciting, but we continue to think that volatility persists until we get more clear evidence that the Fed is done with its tightening cycle, and I don't think we're there yet, unfortunately.
Well, but can't we see the end? Isn't July expected to be the last hike? Do you feel like that's it's going to be done at that point?
I mean, that still remains to be seen. You know, inflation has come off the boil. Employment remains strong. But you're starting to see some slack start to come into the labor force. Right now, it's more on the indirect side, even on, you know, with news today, like from Google, you know, kind of getting people back to the office, being more aggressive, enforcing the hand there. So I think there's still arguments on both sides that make the uncertainty more the status quo as we move into the back half of the year.
All right, so as we get there and we kind of still look for some sign that, you know, we can have conviction, what is that sign? What are you looking for? Or can you already kind of put a stake in the ground and say, you know, this is my trade?
Sure. We're really watching the labor force to take our cues for as far as how the back end goes. You know, I think the perfect scenario is employment stays strong and inflation continues to come down more to that 2% level, 2-3% level that the Fed is looking for. So that's really what we're watching most closely as we look to put money to work in the portfolio.
All right, speaking of putting money to work, a lot of investors have been moving into the semiconductor area. I kind of get it. NVIDIA is still, I think, the top performing name in the S&P 500, up more than 160% this year. There's two names in the chip space that you like. Walk us through your investment thesis on them.
Sure. Well, we like tech for many reasons. You know, right now, when there's uncertainty of the market, you really want to focus on that quality trade. And there's a lot of high profitable quality names within technology. And then going forward, you know, as the cost of capital is rising, you know, even when the Fed completes their tightening cycle, interest rates are going to be higher than they have been for much of the last decade. And so those companies that can invest and grow without tapping the capital markets are at a clear advantage. And that is clearly a space where technology thrives. And names we like there today, given that they haven't run quite as much as the names that you mentioned, our Kulicke and Soffa. It is a small cap semiconductor capital equipment name. And small caps really haven't participated in the same way that large caps have. So they are a high quality name, a leader in their space, and currently trade only at a
It is up 30% this year, though. It is up 30%,
sure.
So it's had a pretty good run this year.
Yeah, I mean, the PE is still relatively low, though, at 15 times, and its cash flow yield is above 8%. So from a relative perspective in that capital equipment space, it's pretty attractive.
So Kulika and Sofa, the ticker is KLIC, click. You also like microchip technology, similar
semi-device company.
Similar space. I mean, the same space, essentially.
Yeah, it's a semiconductor company. It's a little more broadly diversified than some of the others. So it sees about 30% of its revenue come from the industrial space. So that's one of the reasons we like it. It's more of a broader take on semiconductors. You get exposure to many different areas. And it, too, trades at a PE near its 10-year low with a free cash flow yield over 7%. I think what you've seen in the semiconductor space is coming out of the pandemic, you had, you know, inventories very low and the pendulum swung as companies, as customers double ordered. I think that was drove a lot of the weakness last year as inventories accumulated, and that pendulum's kind of swung back to even. And so I think these names have become quite attractive relative to some other sectors in the economy. One, because they can grow, and two, they're highly profitable, which is an important characteristic, not only for us in general, but, you know, with uncertainty in the market, tends to be one of the leading characteristics.
So some of the big household tech names, whether NVIDIA or Intel or some of the other ones, Micron, are you staying away from them? Are they just too expensive for you at this point, or what?
You know, we don't play market timer. We are very long-term investors. We look out over a two to three-year time horizon. So our turnover is typically only 20 to 25% a year. So we do own all those names. But on a relative basis right now, I think you can pick and choose. And there are some areas that haven't participated quite as much as some of the names you mentioned, whether it is NVIDIA, you know, KLA, some of the other names in that semiconductor capital equipment space that have risen even more than the ones we're talking about.
The rest of the market hasn't kind of caught up. It's only been, you know, 7 or 8 big tech companies that have built this rally in the S&P.
But as somebody said this morning on surveillance, I thought it was really interesting. She was a strategist, and she said, well, that's where, though, the cash flow generation is. That's where the growth is. Why wouldn't you, you know, invest in these names?
Like, well, I just wonder if the rest of it – I mean, you like Medtronic, for example. Is healthcare undervalued?
We do think healthcare is undervalued. And I think, you know, when you look again, you know, kind of what's happened since the end of the pandemic, most areas have kind of had that return to normal growth in the business, and healthcare largely has not. You know, you're just now starting to see procedures or doctor visits start to rise again, which ultimately leads to procedures. So a lot of those elective procedures that were canceled during the pandemic, you really haven't seen those come back in any big way, shape, or form. And so these names haven't really participated, you know, since the pandemic ended. And I think there's a big opportunity there to be had. Not only that, you know, in times of uncertainty like we're going through, they tend to be more defensive given the stable revenue and earnings growth.
Can I just, Carol and I focus so much on, you know, New York and San Francisco. Maybe sometimes we're in like Texas or Florida, but what's life like in flyover country there? I mean, you were a Big Red Indian, then you went to Case Western Reserve. Now you're an Akron at Oak Associates. How's Ohio doing?
You got 20 seconds to talk about it.
Ohio's doing great. And I mean, it suits our philosophy, given that we, you know, we don't chase momentum. We're very long-term investors. You know, I think it benefits us not being on the coast, not getting caught up in the day-to-day rumor mill and chasing the momentum on a regular basis. So it benefits us.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.